Hello, I'm Mark DeLuzio. Over the past century, our constitutional republic, grounded in the rule of law, has been transformed into a tyrannical democracy, orchestrated by unelected bureaucrats and globalists. The Constitution is now treated as a suggestion, not the law of the land. Welcome to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God.
Hi, I'm Mark's co-host, Suzette Lawrence. Our intention is to explore the Constitution and discuss how our freedoms and constitutional rights are violated by those very politicians who took an oath on the Bible to uphold it. Learn how the Constitution is the solution to our country's problems. What do we need to do to restore our inalienable and enumerated rights? Class begins now.
Hi, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence from Sedona, Arizona. How are you doing, Suzette?
Doing very well, Mark. Thank you. And yourself?
Oh, I'm doing just great. And the more I learn about Woodrow Wilson, which you're formal, you call him by his full name. I call him Woody. Woody, you have already did an episode on Woody, number 19, I believe. And it was called Woodrow Wilson One, Part One. This is Part Two, okay? And just the listeners, if you want to go back and listen to that one, Part One, Suzette did a really nice job framing up this guy from his birth to the presidency and kind of like his background, his medical issues, his upbringing, all kinds of issues about who this guy really was. And a little bit of demographic stuff too, in terms of being a, you know, president of Princeton and a governor of New Jersey and all that good stuff. So we framed him up in terms of who this guy was, and we're going to get now into his presidency and in particular his second term, and all that. So this is part two, and my guess is the more we dig into this, boy, I'll leave that word out. The more we dig into Woody, the less I like him, and I didn't start at a very high bar to begin with. But as Suzette pointed out in the first episode with him, he is the father of the progressive movement. Now, just remember now, these words are really sexy, right? Progressive. It means you're state of the art, man. You're out there. You've got new thinking. You're forging ground that nobody else really forged before. I love the words here. All a progressive means is, and again, Wilson is the father of the progressive movement. All it means is that you have an unbelievably unpatriotic disdain for our Constitution. You don't think it applies. You don't believe in the three branches of government, the checks and balances, the whole notion of a limited federal government. You don't believe in any of that. That's what it means to be a progressive, okay? And if that's what you want, fine, but get out your wallets because you're going to pay for it, okay? So anyway, I will turn it over to you, Suzette. You did a lot of work on this, and I'll chime in here and there, but this is yours, man. Woody's yours. I'm glad I'm not doing Woody. But
well, Mark, that actually is an excellent summation, because he did not believe in separation of powers.
Right.
So he felt like he could act more like a monarch. He introduced this new constitutionalism and wanted to have more of a nation state as opposed to a United States, which is what we were founded on.
Right.
So who was interested in bringing this guy to power? I mean, how does he move from being a college professor to, or a president of a college, and to becoming a governor, to becoming the president? And of course, it had a lot to do with the bankers. They were fed up. Wall Street was fed up with President Taft because of his trust busting. The bankers liked having a monopoly. J.P. Morgan was king of money on Wall Street, and they persuaded Teddy Roosevelt to run, which split the ticket, because they were, Teddy Roosevelt and Taft ran against Wilson. And that split the ticket, and that's how Wilson won. Also, he won with very wisely attracting women, because even though women did not have the right to vote in all states, there were 20 states that did allow women to vote. And by doing some, by politicking on things like child labor laws and being and the right to vote and prohibition, even though he didn't believe in prohibition, he did politic on it. And that drew women into his the voting box to vote for him. So he really did portray himself as a champion of the people, but really, you know, that he was going to rein in the bankers, he was going to do all these great things for us, but he did none of that. So let's take a look at one of his first issues that is most egregious. And it was the introduction of the 16th Amendment, 1913. This happened almost immediately. The Federal Reserve Act. So he campaigns, like when he's talking to people about the Federal Reserve Act, it's a whisper, right? And it's
the 16th Amendment was the right to tax income, and the Federal Reserve Act was a legislation enacted by Congress, right? Both of
right,
those things.
Right, that came, exactly. Yeah. It came, there were two things, but one, the Federal Reserve Act allowed the Federal Revenue Act to come into be legislated within the next year.
They went hand in hand.
In that same year, we have, you know, somehow moved to a position where income is now being taxed. And when you think of income, think of your labor. So when your labor is taxed, the suggestion is that you are not a free person. Free people don't pay somebody to work. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's period. It's just a very basic theft of your labor. It's taking bread out of your mouth.
It's just along those lines, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thought about the constitutionality, and again, you and I are not Ted Cruz. We're not constitutional lawyers,
right,
and scholars, and people like Mike Lee and all that. But you know, when you or Mark Levin, these guys are brilliant. But I always thought this: we have a protection of our personal property in the Constitution, right? That one of the things protecting our property. And when I earn income, isn't that my property?
It is your property.
Okay, so then it gets confiscated by some formula that the government comes up, which is called the tax code, which is now 10,000 pages plus, and you need 100,000 pages of case law to actually interpret the 10,000 pages. That's how screwed up it is, okay? And I always thought, is that confiscating my wealth because or my property? Because if I go to the store and there's a sales tax, okay, I'm making the decision to pay that. Okay, that's different right. than somebody coming and taking from me. Maybe it's a fine point, but I think it's an important point.
It's a critical point because you don't have to make that purchase. You know,
yeah,
you do not have
to
make the purchase. You know, that's right. Why you're not allowed to tax food.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to, food is not supposed to be taxed. And in some states, supplements are considered food and they're not taxed. Other states do tax supplements. Many states don't. And the reason is because they see it as their a supplement to food. Food should not be taxed. Now, we have right. a little town next to our town in Sedona where they do tax food. You know, in Cottonwood, there's a tax on food. Hmm. So it's, but we run into this issue with the income tax and the way that it's initially introduced to the people is that it's just going to be a tax on the rich.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to get taxed. You know, the working man, the laborer is not going to be taxed. This is just going to be on rich people, and it's going to be on what they considered rich, of course, very subjective. People that have investments, that kind of thing. But you're, you know, stocks, you're going to pay, you know, taxes on that. But the working man will never pay taxes. And of course,
and Suzette, we talked about this in a number of different episodes in the past. But again, I think the liberals today with their, hey, you have to pay your fair share. They think that that's a really classy line that they use. They were using that line back then in 1913 when they passed the 16th Amendment. And most American people agreed because of this fair share hoax, okay, that only the rich got to pay more of their taxes, okay? And they forgot about the fact that these large industries and these capitalists are the ones providing the employment for everybody. But that aside, they used that fair share line back then. It's not original. These people who think they're original with that, is they're wrong. And most Americans supported the income tax.
Well, yeah,
They were hoodwinked.
They were told that this would, you know, once they realized that they were paying and it didn't take long, there was, you know, like you had to
pay, different game.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. It was like, you know, went from 1% to, oh gosh, what was it? Very high rates.
Well, very quickly it went, they doubled it in the first year, I believe, which, oh, big deal. It went from 1% to 2%. That's 100% increase. Okay.
Right. And here's the thing. The income tax, it went as high by the end of World War II, it was at 77%.
Yep.
In 1944, it got as high as 94%. So, you know, we're talking about very high rates, and you could say, oh, well, that the rich were only paying that. Well, how motivated are you to run a business and to work hard when your equity is going to the government?
Right.
You don't keep it. I mean, you know, anything over $220,000, you're paying 94% to the government. I mean, really? So it was, you know, so the income tax is here to stay, and it's created a lot of problems because it allows the government to have revenue to make mischief. You know, they get.
Let's bring this back to, we know that the Congress, Suzette, has a right per the Article 1, Section 8, they have a right to levy taxes, okay? But they also had a provision in the Constitution that said taxes had to be apportioned amongst the state's population, right? So if Connecticut, let's say, represented 8% of the population, then only 8% of the taxes could need to come from there, right? Okay, so this 16th Amendment actually took that away. Now you can tax. Now here's the. Let's always bring this back to Marxism and globalism. Okay, here's the key. Now that I can tax you based on any framework I so desire, I can legislate. Now I'm going to tax you in a graduated rate. Well, guess what? A graduated rate is a tenet of Marxism. Okay, a graduated income tax. It will actually destroy capitalism, which is what it's designed to do. Again, remember what communism is. The state owns all modes of production. Okay, they own everything. You don't have your own business. Okay, you can't be a biocell business like you are. I can't be a global consulting company. Okay, they own everything. Okay. And so let's tie this 16th Amendment back to the fact that that provision in the Constitution now is null and void because of this. And that probably is the worst part of the 16th Amendment, besides their taxing our income, that they got away from this apportioned distribution of taxes. Okay, so anyway, he was all about that. And let's think about it. This gave him a lot more control and a lot more power. Okay, so
it did indeed. Okay. And even without going down this rabbit hole too much, but yes, you're absolutely right, because it wasn't there was they didn't know what a fair share was, which is why it kept increasing. You know, they needed to pay for a war, which they were planning on getting into. They hadn't gotten into the war yet, but they wanted to. And Americans were very resistant to becoming involved in European wars. They just were not. I mean, it was a big, we had barely recovered from the Civil War at this point. I mean, there were Civil War veterans.
I would challenge anybody, Suzette, to be able to define for me what fair share really means.
Let's say you think something's going to cost you $1 million and you have 1 million people, so everybody pays $1. Okay. But if you don't know what something's going to cost and you don't know how many people are actually going to be chipping in, they had no idea. They were shocked their first year of collecting. They didn't have the people to even process the returns. So this created, they had a lot of problems. In the administrative state was new, right? This was
they still have those problems today. I've been waiting for 3 months for the IRS to give me a certificate of residency, which basically says, yeah, you live here. Your business is located in Arizona. It's holding up a few hundred thousand dollars of payments from India because they can't pay me without that certificate. They can't even tell me. It's been now 3 months that I live here. Okay, anyway, let's move on.
So they have the administrative state was a mess, is a mess, and remains a mess.
Yep.
As Judge Napolitano in his book points out, even as they computerized, the IRS computerized, they didn't fire anyone. You know, he was like, well, what was the point? So we have this progressive tax in.
Yep.
This is now 1916. The next big thing that happens that I wanted to bring up was in the 17th Amendment, which to the Constitution, which was ratified in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
And it modified Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution, and it overrode the previous Constitution's provisions on the election of senators, changing it so that they are elected directly by the voting public during elections. Now, in a republic, senators are, in an original republic, senators were elected by the state legislatures. But the argument against that was they wanted to make an end run around the control that parties, machines, special interests had over state legislatures. So they were having this like donor class pressuring people issues back then as well as today. So that's why we elect senators directly. And this is something that
let's bring this right back again to globalism and the tenets of Marxism. One of the tenets of Marxism is that they want a stateless society. They want to eliminate the borders of our states, which basically translates into they want more federal control over our lives. And state sovereignty is not in concert with Marxist thinking. So by doing this exactly, again, let's tie this all back to this whole globalism and Marxism, okay? Which maybe those are repeating the same thing, right? But basically, that's what this was about. They wanted to be able to take the power away from the state legislatures in this regard. And in a sense, you can argue that this was the Senate and the House of Representatives was a mini form of checks and balances. Okay, it made it very difficult to pass legislation and all that. And it would have held the state the federal senators originally as intended, beholden to the states in which they came from. Now, when you look at these senators, they very rarely advocate for their states, but they're always working on global national issues, which I'm not arguing they shouldn't, but the whole idea of being accountable back to where they came from, what state they came from, has eventually evaporated because of this. And this is not in concert with the way the founders set up this this government. But again, it fits right into Woody Wilson's appetite for power and control.
It most certainly did. You know, yep. I mean, he was, it most certainly did. So then we move on to the Revenue Act of 1918, which was there to raise even greater sums for World War One effort. And what they were trying to do at that point, they raised the income tax to 77%. And part of what the problem was is that they introduced the 18th Amendment, which was prohibition. Now, when alcohol was legal, the idea was, you know, it was taxed. So the, you know, the states and the federal government, I'm not sure if they were getting income. I'm sure that somehow I think they were getting income from alcohol sales, but because they wanted, you know, they ended up, but here's where they got into trouble. They wanted to, women, the suffragettes, wanted to ban alcohol. And the reason was, is that alcoholism was a huge problem during the 19th century. I mean, they're saying 15-year-olds consumed and older consumed on average 7 gallons of pure alcohol a year. That's three times as much as people drink today. And this was primarily men, which was wreaking havoc on the lives of their families and the women and their children. And women had few legal rights, or they didn't exercise their legal rights, or didn't have the capacity to exercise their legal rights because they were dependent on their husbands. I mean, women had difficulty getting jobs. You know, it was, if you had a family there, you really couldn't get a job. You know, there wasn't, it was a full, your family was your full-time job. Mm-hmm. So he pushed this prohibition, even though he knew that you could not legislate morality. He knew that, but he did it because he wanted the woman's vote, you know, and that was one of the, in the 20 states that he could get it. So next week, it's 1919, and the 19th Amendment is for women's rights. And of course, to pass an amendment, keep in mind you need 2/3 of each chamber of Congress, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the ratification by 3/4 of the states. So in 1919, 36, that meant we needed 36 of the 48 states had to ratify. And they did. Tennessee cast the deciding vote at that time. Now, it's kind of interesting, just a little bit of history. New Jersey always allowed blacks and women to vote. That was right. Since 1776. And it's very important to realize that the states really had much of their identity. We alluded to this in different podcasts that, like for slavery, for instance, was not a Northern issue. It just wasn't. You know, that's why slaves were escaping to the North. That's why Harriet Tubman was doing what she was doing, you know, bringing right. people North, and why we had people like Frederick Douglass, you know, that were educated men. So, and educated people. So Woodrow Wilson won in 1913 because of the female vote in the Western states, because of his position on child labor laws. Now, here's something that just blew my mind. Maryland, my home state, didn't ratify until 1941. Alabama and Virginia didn't ratify the vote for women until 1959. Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, and Louisiana ratified between 1969 and 1971. And Mississippi ratified in 1984. So it was a, there are different, you know, you could argue that there were different, that we could have dealt with the right to vote in a different way if we had done it constitutionally. You could have amended maybe the Declaration by saying, instead of all men are created equal, that all people are created equal.
Well, I think it was understood though what they meant. They meant mankind, and that's always
they didn't act like it though. They weren't acting like it by not giving women the right to vote. They were not, you know, I mean, and in all fairness, it wasn't just women. It was at one point, wasn't it just property owners that could vote?
Well, look, nothing in the Constitution ever indicated that women couldn't vote, which is why New Jersey did what they did. But what I don't understand with this ratification is that if they passed an amendment, then that is the law of the land. The supremacy clause basically says you don't have a choice to not ratify it because it's federal law. So I don't understand how these states, you know, when you say they didn't ratify until a certain date. So we'd have to look into that because maybe they did it out of protest. I don't know. But,
I don't know.
The Constitution, right, with the 19th Amendment. So, yeah. But anyway, you know, Well, you know, the bottom line in all of this is that 1913 was just a bad year, right? Woody got elected. The Federal Reserve Act, the income tax came in. You know, the League of Nations came in a little bit later, but that was a result of Woody, who actually, you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize on the League of Nations, which turned into the United Nations, which turned into all these other globalist movements as we go through. It was just a real bad year. And I think it was actually the worst year in our history, quite frankly. And we had a lot of bad years. Don't get me wrong. We had 9/11. We had the World War II years. We had a lot of bad years. But if you really think about what year contributed the most to our demise, it's all about this. Now Wilson was a big power-hungry guy, of course. He wanted all the power. So let's talk about when Woody got sick. What about that?
Before we do that, Mark, before we talk about his illness, which is a huge thing, I'd like to just bring up some of the five reasons why the United States got involved in World War One.
Okay.
So we have the number one thing is a ship called the Lusitania, which if you've looked into this, you know about the Lusitania. So it's 1915, and Germany introduced a policy of unrestricted submarine warfare in the Atlantic. So they have submarines, which is new, and nobody really quite understood what they were, but they were patrolling the Irish Channel. And any ships coming, they were at war, right, in Europe and with the UK, and they were bombing, torpedoing any ships that were bringing supplies to the United Kingdom. And so they were this traveling through the Irish Channel was a real, you really took your life into your hands when you did it. And when the Lusitania left New York on May 1st, 1915, bound for Liverpool, it had on board munitions. Now, it was 173 tons of munitions. And there's some question, this was argued in court, that I think in 1917, they argued that, no, these were not war munitions. But in fact, there were, you know, lots of rifle rounds and empty shells and lots of kind of implements of war. And the Russians and the Germans knew that. And they actually posted under, you know, they used to put stuff in the newspaper, like the list when it was leaving and all of that would be in the paper. And directly under that, the Germans put an ad and they said, this ship, it was on their manifest, you know, that they were going to bomb this ship. They said that. This was not a surprise to anyone, but people didn't think they would, because that would have meant that the ship, you know, with Americans on board, that they would be coming, that they would now, that would draw them into World War One. So there was really just a gamble. It was a decision that was made whether the U.S. would actually get involved over the Lusitania. So the Lusitania with these, it didn't have, you know, it was a passenger trip ship. It was a luxury liner, you know, but it did have these munitions on board. It was hit in by the Germans, torpedoed. They torpedoed the front of the ship, so all electricity was wiped out, and the ship sank within 15 minutes. Okay. People were trapped inside of it. They never got to their little boats, you know. 1,198 lives were lost, and 128 Americans were lost, and Americans got angry. And then the second thing the Germans did was they invaded Belgium. And this was, and stories were told about this. They called it the atrocity propaganda. You know, they always say the first casualty of war is the truth. And while horrible things happen in war, they are often embellished if you're trying to draw another country in. And the U.S. government, Wilson and his group wanted to join. Join the war. The third thing were American loans. Now, you have to remember that the Federal Reserve Act has passed. J.P. Morgan is housey-wousey with the White House and Wilson. And they have all these loans out to these European countries. And if those countries lose the war, the money is lost. So they have, you know, they're trying to sell war bonds to make money. Right. So that's the other issue. There was a financial interest in Europe, you know, that this war was being funded by the U.S. So they were trying to sell war bonds. They called them, you know, buy war bonds, you know, the Fourth Liberty Loan. And then the reintroduction of unrestricted submarine warfare, the Germans. When after the Lusitania, the Germans sent a letter, you know, openly apologizing for taking down, you know, for the death of the Americans. But then they started taking down other ships. Cargo vessels were sunk without warning. I mean, the Germans just went nuts, you know.
There you go.
So those are the reasons that, you know, those are the main reasons that we got involved in World War One, and that got President Wilson on, he created something called the 14-point speech.
Right.
And went on the road in Europe to talk to Europeans about this. And then he took it on the road in the U.S. because we were, at that point, we were in the war, but he thought that he could create the League of Nations, and that his speech essentially said that we could end, that the League of Nations could be an international peacekeeping organization, and that it would end wars in general. Right. He would be not having wars. And of course, that's a very good idea. Well, what happens? He takes this, remember, he's sick through this entire time. He's suffering from chronic hypertension, horrible headaches, and he's told that he should be resting, but he comes back from Europe, and Americans are not interested in the League of Nations. They do not want to be part of it. And he goes on a national tour to convince Americans that this is a good idea. And while he's on this tour, on October 19th, 1919, he has a severe stroke and he is incapacitated. I mean, down for the count. And we all know people that have had strokes and that are mildly affected, not Woodrow Wilson. He was severely affected. He was in bed for 18 months. And this was kept secret from the American people, which brings up a huge issue, Mark, that I'd like you to address, if you would, on succession. So the presidency should have moved to his vice president, correct?
Well, no, not at the, yes, at the time, yes, yes. By the way, on this whole war thing, you know, they talk about this, assassination of Kaiser Wilhelm II, right? Austria's leader.
Archduke.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Archduke
Archduke Ferdinand.
Ferdinand of Austria. I'm sorry, and
that's okay.
And, you know, we didn't get involved in that. That was in 1914. We didn't get involved in the war till 1917, you know. But, you know, I think Wilson saw a lot of benefit from being in war. And I think he also maybe saw, and I don't know what was in his head, but this whole business about the League of Nations and how he could maybe move to a more, in the spirit of peace, create these organizations. And Robert Welch called this out. In the spirit of your best interest, Suzette, and your safety, we're going to create all these organizations to protect us, right? And that's you know, again, a lot of the stuff is calculated up front. But you know, when you get into so going back to the Constitution, and you know, he now Wilson was out for 18 months, right? Once he had his stroke. Which was when it was 1918, I think it was, or 17.
17. He had a stroke on October 19th, 1919.
Yeah, so it wasn't until February of 1920 that people started learning of his stroke. He was bedridden all this time. He was incapacitated. Okay, and his wife ran the show.
Edith Congress
didn't know
everything.
About it. His cabinet didn't know about it. How do you not show up for 18 months? And you know, I'm sure they suspected something, but nobody knew about it. Okay. And I remember we didn't have the news media back then. We didn't have TV. We didn't have the internet. So he basically was bedridden and his wife was calling the shots, you know, while he was sitting there, you know, essentially dying from stroke. But let's go back to Article 2. Article 2 in the Constitution has to do with the executive branch, which is the president. And again, I love to say, for those of you in Rio Linda, it's the president. God bless you, Rush Limbaugh. In Section 1, Clause 6 says this. In the case of removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall dissolve of the vice president, and the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and vice president, declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act according until the disability be removed of a president shall be elected. Now, there is a future amendment, can't remember which one, that basically says, hey, Speaker of the House is the third in line, okay?
Right.
In this case, it says the Congress appoints. But the same applies for a vice president, too, in case of both, let's say, in an accident or whatever. But that's what should have happened, okay? Well, we got a guy here, as you pointed out in the first episode, Suzette, and you're pointing out again, that just simply doesn't give a... couldn't care less about the Constitution. Okay.
Yeah.
It's all about power. Okay. Instead of the good of the nation, he's laying there incapacitated from the stroke, paralyzed, blind in one eye. Okay. Running the country from his bed. Nobody knew about it. He's not interfacing with his cabinet. Congress didn't know about it. And this clause never had a chance of being enacted because he wasn't upfront about his condition. Okay. So that's how, if you want to look at this and you say to yourself, you know, that's how much power meant to this guy. And by the way, he was the smartest guy in the room, as you pointed out in the last episode. And if you didn't believe him, I'm sure if you asked him, he'd tell you that. He knew better than anybody. He knew better for the American people. He needed to have more power and control.
I might be wrong, but I'm not confused. That was Woodrow Wilson, you know. He really believed in himself. He was overconfident. And when he did lose his mental capacity, the dishonesty that followed was extraordinary. And I think that's something that we all, as we move forward, have to always keep in mind. Who is the vice president? realize that when you're voting for a president, you're also voting for a vice president. And many times when the vice president is selected by the party, not by the guy. So the president doesn't necessarily select his vice president, does he? He's given somebody. JFK did not select LBJ as his right. vice president.
Right.
Look at what happened. You know,
by the way, LBJ got in through blackmail. Okay.
Oh, he was
Kennedy. And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you the story. She's, I can't remember who Kennedy wanted now as his vice president, but Lyndon Johnson came to his hotel room, Kennedy's hotel room, and with, I don't know who it was, an aide or whatever, showed him pictures of Johnson in bed, Johnson now, with either a spy or some prostitute, and basically said, if you don't pick me, I'm going to show these pictures. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, it's Johnson. Why would he do that? It's because Kennedy would never have gotten elected. The Democratic Party would have gotten such a black eye. Okay. And that's how he ended up picking Johnson. Okay. That's what devious person he was. But getting back to this, you know, here's a guy that, you know, now I want to make a parallel to the globalists of this world, the Schwabs of the world, right? The Klaus Schwabs, who runs the World Economic Forum, John Kerry, Al Gore. I mean, John Kerry, during the last Davos meeting, said, it's amazing how we can assemble these great minds to figure out how to manage and run this world. As sense, that's what he said. And let me tell you, these guys are the brightest in the world, and nobody else can compare, according to them. And that's exactly the arrogant attitude that this Wilson guy had. As he laid there in a stroke, he thought he was still the best to be able to control the show, in although he was incapacitated. Okay.
Mark,
and that's what we got here. That's what we got.
I don't think he was making decisions, honestly. There's no evidence to suggest that he was. His cabinet would meet. She would collect the information and say she would bring it to him, and she would take it to him or to herself. And she would either we don't know who was making decisions. You know, Edith never came clean, and President Wilson died in February of 1924. He did recover somewhat, you know, from the stroke, but he died in Washington. And it's the entire episode of his presidency, from soup to nuts, is just one of the most difficult times in history to fully understand, and to, in my opinion, for me, to respect, because he was so dishonest. You know, if I'm putting my hand on the Bible and taking an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, knowing that I have larceny in my heart, you know, I have no intention of fulfilling this obligation. I'm just doing it to win, to get through, so that I can exercise what I believe is best for the modern world. Because
Edith Wilson, his wife, claimed in her autobiography in 1938 that, and I'll read it. So began my stewardship. I studied every paper sent from their different secretaries or senators and tried to digest and present in tabloid form the things that, despite my vigilance, had to go to the president. I myself never made a single decision regarding the disposition of public affairs. The only decision that was mine was what was important and what was not, and the very important decision of when to present matters to my husband. That's a problem in and of itself. Okay. So you see, these people just don't, they don't give a rat's ass about our Constitution and our people. I mean, right there, she thinks she's coming clean saying, I never made a decision. You did make a decision. You made a decision to decide what he was going to see and what he wasn't going to see. So
she censored him. She sends it. I mean, it's like First Amendment.
Yeah. So anyway,
speech and thought.
It's just unbelievable, quite frankly, of what this guy did and the impact he has on, you know, on our country. So anyway, okay.
Thank you for that clarification. That's very important. I had forgotten that, Edith. I wasn't sure, like, how, if any of the other cabinet members were involved. Like, did anybody figure this out eventually? The guy's been missing in action for a year and a half.
I think they had a suspect, right? I mean, come on. You know,
I mean, you can't be that obtundant. Right. You know, I mean, we understand the president was, but how can you, as a cabinet member, like, ignore this? And again, I think it comes back to, and this is something that Judge Napolitano has pointed out, and Benjamin Franklin pointed out in the beginning, was if you're getting money from the government, then you have a vested interest in seeing the ball, that the ball keeps rolling, even under circumstances like this. So these cabinet members had more than likely had a financial interest in what was happening, and they were not going to give up that power early. They weren't going to change, shift gears. Do we know who his, I can't think of who his vice president was.
It didn't matter. It was Edith. It was his wife. Sorry, I had to say that. Well, look, I think closing this off, I think we're good. And we know he was the big proponent of the League of Nations, which turned out into all these globalist type of, you got to remember, all of these things, Suzette, start out with the right name. They start out with the right, you know, at least promoted intent, but they usually have the opposite effect. And many, many, many times, the opposite effect is calculated. Okay, and so, and we can go down the list of the great things that we came up with as policy. Come on, Affordable Care Act. We could talk about my favorite is the earned income tax credit. Okay, you didn't earn any income, you're going to get a check from the government, but they call it the earned income tax credit. Okay, Social Security. I guess half of that is right because it is socialism, but it's not security. Okay, and I can go down the list of things that we've named: the women's right to choose, the my God, I can go down the list of things to just think about how we label things. And it's
the opposite of what it actually is. You know, the State Department isn't really, there's nothing anyway. But no, I totally get it. It was Thomas Marshall was his vice president. And he was a senatorial political operative. So he may have been the guy that kept the Senate happy. Because he was he was a master of Senate rules and didn't overstep as vice president. That's how he's described on Google.
How could you when you got a tyrant like him, like Wilson? Well, anyway, okay. So final words. I mean, you know, Suzette, just think about, if we were building a house of destruction, Wilson was the guy that created the foundation.
Yes, he was. And I spent a lot of time in the very beginning looking at his family life and the way he was raised, because he was one of the first presidents, the first generations to actually have physical contact with the federal government. You know, before the Civil War, that just wasn't the case. Reconstruction brought, I learned recently that his family home was actually built by money from the federal government because it had been destroyed in the war. So he saw central government as something very positive, you know, totally missing the boat on understanding our Constitution. He thought the Constitution was like step one.
Well, look. Remember what we said in a prior episode. Okay, Wilson actually stated in writing that the checks and balances in our Constitution is a theory.
Oh, that he didn't. Yeah, he definitely didn't believe in separation of powers. And
it's the law. It's the law. It's the law. It's the theory of separation of powers. The theory? It's our freaking law. Okay. And nobody held him accountable for that.
Nobody was challenging him. Nobody was challenging him. And I think a lot of it comes back to they have a financial gain in not doing so.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, by the way, I want to finish, Suzette, with this poem I wrote called Have You Forgotten, right? And I have one on 1913. I have one on Have You Forgotten. And actually, you know what? I'm going to read another one. It's called We the People. This is as if the U.S. Constitution could talk to us today. Okay? So let's assume that the Constitution is a live, living, well, it is a living document. I'm sorry I even said that. But if it could talk. Okay. It's called We the People, If the Constitution Could Talk. How did the people lose their voice? They were destined to be in control. A bold experiment, clearly unique. Whatever happened to America's soul? The framers were wise, they knew of man's nature. Corruption stems from such power. Inform citizenry, a key to defense. Silent and ignorant, most elect to cower. Franklin knew just how fragile I was. A republic, if you can keep it, he'd say. The future looked bright over fruited plains. Today's skies are aflush with shades of gray. Men and women take office to serve this great land. They swear to uphold my provisions. Treated as outdated, I'm mostly ignored. My meaning and essence under constant revision. The founders held that my laws are supreme. Laws made pursuant are the laws of the land. Courts refuse to honor my essence. Those who defend me are ruthlessly banned. Religions and morality are indispensable supports, said Washington as he bid farewell. As we divorce our relationship with God the Almighty, our morality's decline in undeniable hell. Can't we get Americans simply to read me? September 17th, at least once a year? A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Devoid of knowledge, our futures austere. So many times my essence is trampled. However, I vow to persist. Fight for me, it's up to you, or our nation may cease to exist. So that's my poem on We the People, If Amen. Our Constitution Could Talk. So
thank you for that, Mark. It really does put a nice bow on a tough subject.
I also have one that which we'll read another time, is If the Country Could Talk. Okay. Very similar
It's kind of interesting because with the many citizen journalists out there, how much, and I know a lot of people don't listen. That's all I listen to now. Yeah. I listen to professional journalists that got fired. Unless you got fired or kicked off the board of one of the big ABC, CBS, Fox.
Hey, it's a sign of accomplishment if you did.
If they got rid of you, I'm in. I'm listening to what you have to say. And I'm listening, and I'm also listening to, there's some citizen journalists that are excellent. You know, there's a guy named Greg Reese who does these 4 and 5 minute reports. Yep. They're extraordinary, where he just really nutshells everything for the person with a short attention span.
Hey, by the way, I got to tell you a funny story before we go. Sure. So when I was used to be in Connecticut, I was the chairman of the Glastonbury, Connecticut town Republican committee. I was the chairman. And I went to, so we had this state party thing where we elect the state party hacks that are all over the state, elect the chairman of the GOP for the state of Connecticut. So one of the guys that I really liked, a good friend of mine, Joe Markley, who ran for lieutenant governor. He was a state senator and a real strict constitutionalist and also intellectually brilliant, was running against this guy named Romano. And I went to, they had a debate, and they went to the debate, and Romano started his opening introduction as, "I'm the only Republican in Connecticut that got endorsed by the New York Times." Okay, now, so I'm sitting there saying, what's worse, the fact that he got endorsed by the New York Times, or the fact that he thinks that's a badge of honor? Okay.
I mean, like, how disconnected is this guy?
And let me tell you, he got elected. Okay. All the Rhino hacks who love John Kasich and people like that elected this guy, and he ran the party into the ground, and they lost big time in a year that we should have clean house. Okay. And we didn't. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there because I think it's kind of interesting when you start looking at these people out here who think they're, you know, they're big constitutionalists and they're big conservatives. They have no clue what's going on. So, Suzette, nice job on this. We'll probably do more of Woody. Woody's going to come up a lot over the next several episodes, I'm sure, because we have to always go back to how he set the table. So any closing thoughts?
No, I think this has been very interesting. It's been difficult because he's did so much to lay the foundation for what we're living in now. And many that came after him, you know, just added additional layers. I mean, think of FDR.
Hey, wait till we get into FDR. We're going to do that. Wait till we get into Teddy Roosevelt. Okay. I have a teddy bear collection. I feel like burning it. Sorry. I mean,
these guys were real. They really did. I think they always had a kind of inferiority complex mm-hmm. about being American instead of European. And they kept trying to, they couldn't find their pride in being American. They wanted to be, they were always talking about Europe, going to school in Europe, going to finishing school in Europe, the Swiss finish, you know, the whole thing. And I just don't think that they fully respected their own country or themselves because.
Well, you can't if you don't respect the Constitution, then you can't tell me that you respect our country.
No.
Our country and our Constitution is the most unique. They still call it an experiment, and if you have a disdain for our Constitution, then I'm sorry. The conversation's over, right? So, okay.
Thanks,
awesome. Mark. Nice job. Okay, we'll see you next time, Suzette. This was episode 21 on Woody Wilson. I'm sorry. Woodrow Wilson. Part 2. Okay. Suzette, we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Take care, everyone. Thank
okay,
you, Mark.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Constitution Solution, one podcast under God, where we hold that strict adherence to the Constitution is the solution to most of our country's problems.
You can find other episodes on our website at 1787solution.com, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and most other platforms. We're your hosts, Mark DeLuzio and Suzette Lawrence. Until next time, may God bless you and may God bless America.